Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Okay.
This is Kyle De Buena Froley for Detours. Rebellions fill history books with evocative names. The Peasants' Revolt of 1381, the Storming of Bastille, the Velvet Revolution and the Arab Spring, and now, the not quite as poetic sounding Occupy Wall Street, or whatever it's called in a town near you. Detours will explore revolts staged in familiar places. These are moments of insurrections that play out in kitchens, classrooms, and parking lots every day, sometimes to great effect and sometimes to no effect at all. Today on Detours, we bring you small acts of rebellion, treacherous plots, daring coups, escapes on rollerblades. Yep, we've got one of those too. But back to Occupy LA for a moment.
To stop corporate greed under the slogan, we are the 99%. And today,
I went downtown to check out the rebellion myself. As you expect, people were angry about some pretty big things. Corporate greed, heartless bankers, a lack of jobs. But one woman I met was especially shaken up. Not by the fall of the middle class, but by the uncomfortable realities that come along with rebelling.
And one, you're not being paid. Two, you're living in a tent in downtown Los Angeles. And three, you don't know if it's going anywhere.
Okay, so maybe in our heart of hearts, we know rebellion isn't as fun or as romantic as it looks in the movies. But what if the whole messy process makes you want to revolt against the rebellion?
Fucking day, I question whether or not I should be here, whether or not I'm supporting the right thing, how I could possibly ensure some kind of success, and there's no way to do it. Like, all we
the French may have had their cry of liberty, equality, and brotherhood, but for this rebellion, in this city, maybe the motto should be something more like...
I'm freely willing to admit it that I am miserable right now. I just worked way too hard.
Misery, uncertainty, weird smells. They all come along with rebellion. But they don't stop us. Over and over again, people find ways to push back against what they see as injustice. Stay with us as we plumb the depths of a human soul, one small act of rebellion at a time. It's a problem as old as rebellion itself. The message gets muddled in the actual act of sticking it to the man. Caitlin Parker remembers one instance that was supposed to be a striking display of individuality. Instead, her antics fizzled into the background. There was a big reveal later, but not in the way she'd expected.
So this was probably my sophomore year of high school at McKinney High in McKinney, Texas. And I had grown up there all my life. Fine place to grow up. But I think coming into high school, I was in this place where I wasn't playing sports. I wasn't into high school football, which is kind of a sin in rural Texas. I was in theater, but I wasn't very good. So I was getting like the bit parts in the play. I'd tried to boycott the Sadie Hawkins dance, but a one-person boycott isn't very effective, especially when I just didn't go because I didn't have anyone to ask. So I was kind of in this down in the dumps place, you know, upset with no real reason to be upset. I had everything I could ever want or need. But I wasn't so much into the community, the scene, but my parents really were. They were pretty active in local politics and the school board and charities. And so I got the feeling that people always kind of wondered, like, what is up with Phil and Kathy's daughter? She is a weirdo. When looking back, I'm sure that people didn't think about me at all, one way or the other. But a couple times a year, my parents would throw various events at the house. And so this was one, I remember it was on for Mardi Gras on Fat Tuesday. And I think it was a fundraiser for something. And they had set up a really nice catered buffet, and I want to say there were musicians and lots of beads and masks and everything else. And you know, for these parties, my younger brother and I were sort of expected to be present and look nice and be polite, but you know, sort of be on the sidelines, not really making a scene at these things. So I think, you know, I was wearing some party dress with purple and green accessories and sort of got the okay from my parents, and went upstairs and sort of waited for this party to start. And sometime in this waiting period, I decided that I didn't want to be wearing this stupid dress and making nice conversation with adults that I didn't really know or care about, sort of that general teenage angst. And so I changed into a pair of holy jeans and I think a flannel, you know, button-up shirt, something that was kind of faux hippie, but, you know, outrageous enough for rural Texas. And so I wait until the party is really swinging with lots of people and, you know, come downstairs in this raggedy outfit, thinking that my mom will be horrified but won't really be able to make a scene because there are all these important people in our house. And she does see me and shoots me a look and raises an eyebrow, but as I thought, sort of just went back to her conversation. And so I decide that I want some of this delicious Cajun food that's being served at Mardi Gras, but instead of, you know, just taking a plate off the buffet line like normal people, I go into our pantry. I remember having to tap the mayor on the shoulder to ask him to move out from in front of the pantry and grab a couple of brown paper sacks that I use to pack my lunch in every day, and then just start going through this buffet line, you know, amidst all the town dignitaries, if you have dignitaries in a small Texas town, just dumping food sort of indiscriminately into these brown paper bags. And since it was Cajun food, you had, you know, jambalaya being heaped on top of red beans and rice with some crayfish thrown in there. And then just, you know, going all the way through and adding some bread pudding to top it all off. And I remember getting weird looks from people like, what are you doing? Just dumping all of this food in a bag. But I think I filled up a couple of these sacks and, you know, they're leaking and about to burst open, but taking them upstairs and having a nice moment with my brother. He was 6 years younger, so probably 9 or 10 at the time. But we had this sort of fun moment just eating all of this delicious, rich food, probably with our hands out of these bags and, you know, not really giving a care what was going on downstairs. And then I'm sure the party ended. Everyone went home. No one really cared that I had changed out of my dress. I don't think I even ever got a talking to from my parents. They knew I was kind of weird, I think. But about 2 weeks later, a really bad smell started to come from my brother's room. Like, it smelled like something had died in there. And as it turns out, yeah, all the food we had eaten, all the crayfish shells, the leftovers, we had just crammed back in these bags. And I guess my brother had sort of put them underneath his bed and left them there. And 2-week-old Cajun food does not smell very good. And I think everything had leaked through the bags and onto the carpet and everything else. And so my brother ended up being the one who really got in trouble for not cleaning up his room. And in true older sister fashion, of course, I didn't fess up. I let him shoulder all of that blame.
Some rebellions start with a murmur, and over time, that first whisper grows into a roar. Other uprisings are more spontaneous.
Liz! 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 Liz!
My name is Elizabeth, and the first piece of advice my dad ever gave me growing up was never let anyone call you Liz. And I was obsessed with this. I refused. No Lizzie, no Liz, no Beth. Every teacher, every classmate, every enemy, they still called me Elizabeth. But I was in this class one day, and we had this substitute physical education teacher, and we were in this gym class that was taking us to the East River Promenade, and we were taking rollerblading classes. And for 45 minutes each class, we'd go out and we'd sort of learn how to rollerblade up and down this sort of 2-mile stretch of the promenade on the East River. The substitute teacher had a list of our names. She knew me. It was a small school. She knew my name was Elizabeth. She yet she still kept on calling me Liz, calling me in attendance. Liz, I said. Elizabeth. She, you know, instructed me on how to rollerblade. Liz, you should do it this way. I said, it's Elizabeth. And this went back and forth. Liz, this. No, I go by Elizabeth. And I really had enough. I mean, I was going to snap. My tone was already probably not the tone you should be taking with a teacher, but I just thought, why is this woman not respecting my name? It's like she was calling me, you know, Gertrude. It was just not my name. And so there I was, and I was rollerblading around, and I thought, I'm just going to keep on going past the boundaries. And next thing I heard was, Liz, Liz, Liz! But I kept on going. I didn't look back, and I just kept on going, and I escaped for the entire duration of our class. And I knew I was going to be in trouble. And sure enough, I got back, and the teacher had reported me to the principal's office. And in my defense, I said, well, she didn't call my name.
Most rebellions want to tear down the establishment. Ariel Edwards Levy brings us this story of a quiet, orderly rebellion.
Leonore Sedano spent a lot of her senior year stuck in the principal's office, which was strange because Leonore is not exactly a troublemaker. She's the kind of girl who studies for bio class in her spare time. And here's the really weird part. That's how she got in trouble in the first place. Leonore went to high school in Maywood, which is a tiny city, about the size of 1 square mile, near downtown L.A. If you've heard of Maywood at all, it was probably last year. The city was so in debt that it laid off all of its staff and disbanded the local police force. Maywood Academy High School was supposed to be a gem among the city's problems. It was brand new, great facilities. But the problem wasn't the construction. The problem was the teachers. Leonore was taking honors classes, but they weren't quite living up to her expectations. Her first bio teacher left midway through the year. And her replacement?
He got his degree before DNA was discovered, and we were like, that's most of bio.
Instead of doing labs or taking tests, they mostly watched movies. AP English wasn't much more work. Halfway through the year, the teacher still hadn't assigned a real essay.
I thought it was weird that we weren't writing anything. When we did write, we kind of graded ourselves. We wanted her to review our writing because we wanted her opinion, but she only did that once. And we were kind of worried because we didn't know what to expect. We're just students. We haven't acquired all the language that is needed, and she refused to give us that.
To a lot of seniors, this would sound pretty much perfect. No homework, no tests, no grades. But Leonore and her friends knew no one was expecting all that much from them, and it rubbed them the wrong way.
We really want to prove people wrong. Like, for me, I really felt that because of the school that I went to, a lot of people would not take me very seriously. So I didn't want to reflect that. I really wanted to counter that. Our English teacher would always tell us that society always puts us down because we do live in, like, an inner-city school.
The seniors tried staging a walkout. That's what got her sent to the principal's office the first time.
We just were kind of mad, and we were even more mad when we went to the principal and she didn't think we were thinking for ourselves. The principal thought that we were being led by some teacher, so in turn we took matters into our own hands.
Leonore and her friends had had enough. They met to plan their ultimate act of rebellion. Whether the school liked it or not, they were going to learn. They shared study guides and took turns preparing lessons. One student would make slideshows and assign homework on the honor system. Sharing copies of the Princeton Review is a pretty weird way to rebel. But to the Maywood seniors, it was the best way they knew of defying expectations.
It was just a very weird situation that we were in. And we really didn't want to fail.
And at the time, Leonore says, they didn't realize how strange the whole idea, students fighting to work harder, really was.
When I came to college, I realized that we really were at a disadvantage because we really had nothing to compare ourselves. We just knew each other and it felt kind of unfair, but at least now I know that I can succeed even if there's no one backing me up. We can do better and that really nothing that stands in our way.
Leonore Sedano is now a sophomore at UC Irvine, where the professors are more than happy to grade work. She's studying biomedical engineering.
Rebellion, antics, mischief. For some kids, it's all just a part of growing up. Dan Parker was one of those kids. You know, the kind to throw a dish onto the roof and wonder why his mom was so mad about it. Well, we got Dan into the studio to see if he could make sense of all those senseless stunts he pulled. We have our act together.
All right.
Now we're ready.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. Yeah. Let's travel back in time. The title of this is called Small Acts of Rebellion.
Right.
We want to know how you fit into this. Were you a rebellious person? What's one of the first things that you remember doing that just like maybe you pissed off someone just a little bit, like a little?
For lunch, I always had to sit down at the kitchen table and I always had to have a full glass of milk. I would get in trouble if I didn't drink my milk. I wouldn't get to do like my activities. I wouldn't get to go do the things I wanted to do. And as a kid, I really did not like milk at all. And every day you need to like find a solution that's not gagging it down. So I would go, you know, try to bring my cup to the bathroom and pour it down the toilet. I would try to quickly run to the sink and pour it down when she wasn't looking. But I pretty much got caught every single time. And I found a hole in the ground behind me that I wasn't really quite sure what it was. And so I would just take my full glass of milk. And when my mom turned her back, I would turn around and dump the milk down the hole. That went on for like months until the winter came around and my parents turned on the heat for the first time and our whole house basically got the smell of rancid milk and they couldn't figure out what it was and they just knew that every time the heat was on the whole house smelled like rotten milk. And it turns out that was the heating vent that went down into like a central heating duct of our house and basically found a huge sticky pile of old moldy milk from where I'd poured it down the heating vent.
That is so foul. So disgusting. Wait, yeah. Okay, so the first time it happens, you smell this milk and you're like...
As soon as I smelt it, I started to like build up my case as to why it wasn't my fault.
Already you were planning ahead.
Yeah, because I guess I wasn't sure how directly it was going to get tied back to me. Just this foul smell, and then it was like very clearly tied back to me, like to the place I sit at the table with the hole right behind it. I would say that out of my family and extended family that I was probably branded for my entire life as the troublemaker.
You have
the
that
family. Yeah.
You have that reputation.
Yeah.
Did it.
So I would like do all these things. Like we had this huge metal fan in my second grade class and I took a rubber eraser and threw it into the fan just because I wanted to see what would happen. And it shredded it and it blew it all over the classroom and made a huge amount of noise. And we had to take the fan out of the class for, like, the rest of the hot summer. You know, you, like, learn that certain things are wrong over time. But I would like to say that I was, like, expressing my creativity in an unconventional way. There was just a lot of times that there was, like, a normal way of going about something. And I guess I just had, like, an overactive curiosity. And I just was, like, wondering. I had all these what-if scenarios. Like, what would happen if I did this? What would happen if I did that? And some would, you know, I would just do like the cost, you know, quick cost benefit, you know, in my head. And if I felt like either the benefit of it would be really cool, like throwing a racer in a fan, and the cost would be like a talking to where I could like try to black them out, then I would just do it. A Honestly, sometimes I would listen, I think. Other times, I distinctly remember trying to, like, black out as my mom was talking to me and just nodding my head so that I could get through that discussion and do whatever else it was that I needed to do. And I think that's probably why I had the repeat conversation so often. It probably weren't sticking as well as my parents hoped they would. You just kind of like get these talking to's over, you know, the entire extent of your life of like, this is wrong, this is not how we do things, this is not how you behave, this is not how you get a good grade, this is not how you make a recommendation in business without support. And so there's all these things that are guiding you towards a safe path, which is why people actually need training in business school to learn how to be creative again. And people need professional development in the workforce in order to get their creativity back.
And you've already had the leg up.
So. Yeah, I think it's just, mine didn't go away. I think I just tried to like disguise it over time and then it kind of gradually resurfaced, but in a more productive way. I think that when I entered the professional world in consulting, that kind of probably was a bit of a turning point because I started out in a class of about 25 people at my level, and I excelled faster than my class. And I wasn't trying harder. I wasn't actively doing anything different than they were. I wasn't like playing any political games or anything. But I was just, I just questioned things more. I just, you know, I didn't just do what was told of me to do. I would question, well, why am I doing this? You know, what are we aiming for? And, you know, ultimately with this goal. You know, maybe the questions I was asking when I was young, like, why do I have to drink milk? Like, why do I have to wear this bathing suit? Why can't I scratch into this truck? Were not productive questions, but they were like questions nonetheless about how, like, how I should be acting or what I should be doing. So I think in the professional world, I got to a level of depth and understanding that my peer group maybe didn't get to. Because people had thought they might look dumb if they were asking these questions. Maybe I just didn't hold anything back because I had looked dumb in the past. Think outside the box. Like, what does that really mean? I think that means going back to the days when you were like a kid and you're like, well, I don't really want to drink milk and I shouldn't have to do something that I don't like, even if like I'm a kid, so I'm going to pour it down the heating vent. Like, it's kind of going back to those gut reactions that you had when a kid that you kind of like learn to quiet as you grow up.
Detours comes out of USC's Annenberg School of Journalism. On the team, Arielle Edwards-Levy, Emily Frost, Caitlin Parker, Karen Lowe, Melissa Reynolds, Willa Seidenberg, and me, Kyle Tabuena-Froley. And a very special thanks to the people we pulled into the podcast. Elizabeth Not Liz Wolf, Leonor Sedano, and Dan Parker. Thanks for listening. This is Detours. On the next episode of Detours, the anatomy of a crush.
I said earlier, as I was leaving the house, that I'm really, really nervous. I figured if I could just go up and ask him before dance practice to sort of see if I could talk to him afterwards. That's what I plan on doing.
That's next time on Detours.